under the conduct of Vulcaris, a bold Herulian, who rashly conceived that personal bravery was the sole duty and merit of a commander. As he marched without order or precaution along the Aemilian Way, an ambuscade of Franks suddenly arose from the amphitheatre of Parma. His troops were surprised and routed, but their leader refused to fly, declaring to the last moment that death was less terrible than the angry countenance of Narses. The death of Vulcaris and the retreat of the surviving chiefs decided the fluctuating and rebellious temper of the Goths. They flew to the standard of their deliverers and admitted them into the cities which still resisted the arms of the Roman general. The conqueror of Italy opened a free passage to the irresistible torrent of barbarians. They passed under the walls of Cesena, and answered by threats and reproaches the advice of Alagaon that the Gothic treasures could no longer repay the labor of an invasion. 2,000 francs were destroyed by the skill and valor of Narses himself, who sailed from Rimini at the head of 300 horse to chastise the licentious rapine of their march. On the confines of Samnium, the two brothers divided their forces. With the right wing, Bucolin assumed the spoil of Campania, Lucania, and Bruttium. With the left, Lothair accepted the plunder of Apulia and Calabria. They followed the coast of the Mediterranean and the Adriatic as far as Rhegium and Otranto, and the extreme lands of Italy were the term of their destructive progress. The Franks, who were Christians and Catholics, contented themselves with simple pillage and occasional murder. But the churches, which their piety had spared, were stripped by the sacrilegious hands of the Alamanni, who sacrificed horses' heads to their native deities of the woods and rivers. They melted or profaned the consecrated vessels, and the ruins of shrines and altars were stained with the blood of the faithful. Bucolin was actuated by ambition, and Lothair by avarice. The former aspired to restore the Gothic kingdom. The latter, after a promise to his brother of speedy succours, returned to the same road to deposit his treasure beyond the Alps. The strength of their armies was already wasted by the change of climate and contagion of disease. The Germans reveled in the vintage of Italy, and their own intemperance avenged, in some degree, the miseries of a defenseless people. At the entrance of the spring, the imperial troops who had guarded the cities assembled to the number of 18,000 men in the neighborhood of Rome. Their winter hours had not been consumed in idleness. By the command and after the example of Narses, they repeated each day their military exercise on foot and on horseback, accustomed their ear to obey the sound of the trumpet, and practiced the steps and evolutions of the Pyrrhic dance. From the Straits of Sicily, Bucolin, with 30,000 Franks and Alamanni, slowly moved towards Capua, occupied with a wooden tower the bridge of Casilinum, covered his right by the stream of the Volturnus, and secured the rest of his encampment by a rampart of sharp stakes and a circle of wagons whose wheels were buried in the earth. He impatiently expected the return of Lothair, ignorant, alas, that his brother could never return, and that the chief and his army had been swept away by a strange disease on the banks of the Lake Bernacus, between Trent and Verona. The banners of Narses soon approached the Volturnus, and the eyes of Italy were anxiously fixed on the event of this final contest. Perhaps the talents of the Roman general were most conspicuous in the calm operations which precede the tumult of a battle. His skillful movements intercepted the subsistence of the barbarian, deprived him of the advantage of the bridge and river, and in the choice of the ground and moment of action reduced him to comply with the inclination of his enemy. On the morning of the important day, when the ranks were already formed, a servant, for some trivial fault, was killed by his master, one of the leaders of the Heruli. The justice or passion of Narses was awakened. He summoned the offender to his presence, and without listening to his excuses, gave the signal to the minister of death. If the cruel master had not infringed the laws of his nation, This arbitrary execution was not less unjust than it appears to have been imprudent. The Heruli felt the indignity. They halted, but the Roman general, without soothing their rage or expecting their resolution, called aloud as the trumpet sounded that unless they hastened to occupy their place, they would lose the honor of the victory. His troops were disposed in a long front, the cavalry on the wings, in the center the heavy-armed foot, the archers and slingers in the rear. The Germans advanced in a sharp-pointed column of the form of a triangle or solid wedge. They pierced the feeble center of Narses, who received them with a smile into the fatal snare, and directed his wings of cavalry insensibly to wheel on their flanks and encompass their rear. The host of the Franks and Alemanni consisted of infantry. A sword and buckler hung by their side, and they used as their weapons of offense a weighty hatchet and a hooked javelin, which were only formidable in close combat or at a short distance. The flower of the Roman archers on horseback and in complete armor skirmished without peril round this immovable phalanx, supplied by active speed the deficiency of number, and aimed their arrows against a crowd of barbarians who, instead of a cuirass and helmet, were covered by a loose garment of fur or linen. They paused, they trembled, their ranks were confounded, and in the decisive moment the Heruli, preferring glory to revenge, charged with rapid violence the head of the column. Their leader, Zinbal, and Alegern, the Gothic prince, deserved the pride of superior valor, and their example excited the victorious troops to achieve with swords and spears the destruction of the enemy. Bucolan and the greatest part of his army perished on the field of battle, in the waters of the Volturnus, or by the hands of the enraged peasants. But it may seem incredible that a victory, which no more than 5 of the Alemanni survived, could be purchased with the loss of 40 Romans. 7,000 Goths, the relics of the war, defended the fortress of Campsa till the ensuing spring, and every messenger of Narses announced the reduction of the Italian cities, whose names were corrupted by the ignorance or vanity of the Greeks. After the battle of Casilinum, Narses entered the capital. The arms and treasures of the Goths, the Franks, and the Alemanni were displayed. His soldiers, with garlands in their hands, chanted the praises of the conqueror, and Rome, for the last time, beheld the semblance of a triumph. After a reign of 60 years, the throne of the Gothic kings was filled by the exarchs of Ravenna, the representatives in peace and war of the Emperor of the Romans. Their jurisdiction was soon reduced to the limits of a narrow province, but Narses himself, the first and most powerful of the exarchs, administered above 15 years the entire kingdom of Italy. Like Belisarius, he had deserved the honors of envy, calumny, and disgrace, but the favorite eunuch still enjoyed the confidence of Justinian, or the leader of a victorious army awed and repressed the ingratitude of a timid court. Yet it was not by weak and mischievous indulgence that Narses secured the attachment of his troops. Forgetful of the past and regardless of the future, they abused the present hour of prosperity and peace. The cities of Italy resounded with the noise of drinking and dancing. The spoils of victory were wasted in sensual pleasures, and nothing, says Agathias, remained unless to exchange their shields and helmets for the soft lute and the capacious hogshead. In a manly oration, not unworthy of a Roman censor, the eunuch reproved these disorderly vices which sullied their fame and endangered their safety. The soldiers blushed and obeyed. Discipline was confirmed. The fortifications were restored. A duke was stationed for the defense and military command of each of the principal cities, and the eye of Narses pervaded the ample prospect from Calabria to the Alps. The remains of the Gothic nation evacuated the country or mingled with the people. The Franks, instead of revenging the death of Bucelen, abandoned without a struggle their Italian conquests, and the rebellious Sinbal, chief of the Heruli, was subdued, taken, and hung on a lofty gallows by the inflexible justice of the exarch. The civil state of Italy, after the agitation of a long tempest, was fixed by a pragmatic sanction, which the emperor promulgated at the request of the pope. Justinian introduced his own jurisprudence into the schools and tribunals of the West. He ratified the acts of Theodoric and his immediate successors, but every deed was rescinded and abolished which force had extorted or fear had subscribed under the usurpation of Totila. A moderate theory was framed to reconcile the rights of property with the safety of prescription, the claims of the state with the poverty of the people, and the pardon of offences with the interest of virtue and the order of society. Under the exarchs of Ravenna, Rome was degraded to the second rank. Yet the senators were gratified by the permission of visiting their estates in Italy and of approaching, without obstacle, the throne of Constantinople. The regulation of weights and measures was delegated to the Pope and Senate, and the salaries of lawyers and physicians, of orators and grammarians, were destined to preserve or rekindle the light of science in the ancient capital. Justinian might dictate benevolent edicts, and Narses might second his wishes by the restoration of cities, and more especially of churches. But the power of kings is most effectual to destroy. And the 20 years of the Gothic War had consummated the distress and depopulation of Italy. As early as the 4th campaign, under the discipline of Belisarius himself, 50,000 laborers died of hunger in the narrow region of Picenum, and a strict interpretation of the evidence of Procopius would swell the loss of Italy above the total sum of her present inhabitants. I desire to believe, but I dare not affirm, that Belisarius sincerely rejoiced in the triumph of Narses. Yet the consciousness of his own exploits might teach him to esteem without jealousy the merit of a rival, and the repose of the aged warrior was crowned by a last victory which saved the emperor and the capital. The barbarians who annually visited the provinces of Europe were less discouraged by some accidental defeats than they were excited by the double hope of spoil and of subsidy. In the 32nd winter of Justinian's reign, the Danube was deeply frozen. Zabergan led the cavalry of the Bulgarians, and his standard was followed by a promiscuous multitude of Sclavonians. The savage chief passed, without opposition, the river and the mountains, spread his troops over Macedonia and Thrace, and advanced with no more than 7,000 horse to the long wall which should have defended the territory of Constantinople. But the works of man are impotent against the assaults of nature. A recent earthquake had shaken the foundations of the wall, and the forces of the empire were employed on the distant frontiers of Italy, Africa, and Persia. The 7 schools or companies of the guards or domestic troops had been augmented to the number of 5,500 men, whose ordinary station was in the peaceful cities of Asia. But the places of the brave Armenians were insensibly supplied by lazy citizens who purchased an exemption from the duties of civil life without being exposed to the dangers of military service. Of such soldiers, few could be tempted to sally from the gates, and none could be persuaded to remain in the field unless they wanted strength and speed to escape from the Bulgarians. The report of the fugitives exaggerated the numbers and fierceness of an enemy who had polluted holy virgins and abandoned newborn infants to the dogs and vultures. A crowd of rustics imploring food and protection increased the consternation of the city, and the tents of Zabergan were pitched at the distance of 20 miles on the banks of a small river which encircles Melanthius and afterwards falls into the Propontis. Justinian trembled, and those who had only seen the emperor in his old age were pleased to suppose that he had lost the alacrity and vigor of his youth. By his command, the vessels of gold and silver were removed from the churches in the neighborhood and even the suburbs of Constantinople. The ramparts were lined with trembling spectators. The Golden Gate was crowded with useless generals and tribunes, and the Senate shared the fatigues and the apprehensions of the populace. But the eyes of the prince and people were directed to a feeble veteran, who was compelled by the public danger to resume the armor in which he had entered Carthage and defended Rome. The horses of the royal stables, of private citizens, and even of the circus, were hastily collected. The emulation of the old and young was roused by the name of Belisarius, and his first encampment was in the presence of a victorious enemy. His prudence and the labor of the friendly peasants secured, with a ditch and rampart, the repose of the night. Innumerable fires and clouds of dust were artfully contrived to magnify the opinion of his strength. His soldiers suddenly passed from despondency to presumption, and while 10,000 voices demanded the battle, Belisarius dissembled his knowledge that in the hour of trial he must depend on the firmness of 300 veterans. The next morning the Bulgarian cavalry advanced to the charge, but they heard the shouts of multitudes. They beheld the arms and discipline of the front. They were assaulted on the flanks by two ambuscades which rose from the woods. Their foremost warriors fell by the hand of the aged hero and his guards, and the swiftness of their evolutions was rendered useless by the close attack and rapid pursuit of the Romans. In this action, so speedy was their flight, the Bulgarians lost only 400 horse. But Constantinople was saved, and Zabergan, who felt the hand of a master, withdrew to a respectful distance. But his friends were numerous in the councils of the emperor, and Belisarius obeyed with reluctance the commands of envy and Justinian, which forbade him to achieve the deliverance of his country. On his return to the city, the people, still conscious of their danger, accompanied his triumph with acclamations of joy and gratitude, which were imputed as a crime to the victorious general. But when he entered the palace, the courtiers were silent, and the emperor, after a cold and thankless embrace, dismissed him to mingle with the train of slaves. Yet so deep was the impression of his glory on the minds of men that Justinian, in the 77th year of his age, was encouraged to advance near 40 miles from the capital and to inspect in person the restoration of the Long Wall. The Bulgarians wasted the summer in the plains of Thrace, but they were inclined to peace by the failure of their rash attempts on Greece and the Chersonesus. A menace of killing their prisoners quickened the payment of heavy ransoms, and the departure of Zabergan was hastened by the report that double-prowed vessels were built on the Danube to intercept his passage. The danger was soon forgotten, and a vain question, whether their sovereign had shown more wisdom or weakness, amused the idleness of the city. Part 4. About 2 years after the last victory of Belisarius, the emperor returned from a Thracian journey of health or business or devotion. Justinian was afflicted by a pain in his head, and his private entry countenanced the rumor of his death. Before the third hour of the day, the baker's shops were plundered of their bread, the houses were shut, and every citizen, with hope or terror, prepared for the impending tumult. The senators themselves, fearful and suspicious, were convened at the ninth hour, and the prefect received their commands to visit every quarter of the city and proclaim a general illumination for the recovery of the emperor's health. The ferment subsided. But every accident betrayed the impotence of the government and the factious temper of the people. The guards were disposed to mutiny as often as their quarters were changed or their pay was withheld. The frequent calamities of fires and earthquakes afforded the opportunities of disorder. The disputes of the blues and greens, of the orthodox and heretics, degenerated into bloody battles, and in the presence of the Persian ambassador, Justinian blushed for himself and for his subjects. Capricious pardon and arbitrary punishment embittered the irksomeness and discontent of a long reign. A conspiracy was formed in the palace, and unless we are deceived by the names of Marcellus and Sergius, the most virtuous and the most profligate of the courtiers were associated in the same designs. They had fixed the time of the execution. Their rank gave them access to the royal banquet, and their black slaves were stationed in the vestibule and porticos to announce the death of the tyrant and to excite a sedition in the capital. But the indiscretion of an accomplice saved the poor remnant of the days of Justinian. Conspirators were detected and seized, with daggers hidden under their garments. Marcellus died by his own hand, and Sergius was dragged from the sanctuary. Pressed by remorse, or tempted by the hopes of safety, he accused two officers of the household of Belisarius, and torture forced them to declare that they had acted according to the secret instructions of their patron. Posterity will not hastily believe that a hero who, in the vigor of life, had disdained the fairest offers of ambition and revenge, should stoop to the murder of his prince, whom he could not long expect to survive. His followers were impatient to fly, but flight must have been supported by rebellion, and he had lived enough for nature and for glory. Belisarius appeared before the council with less fear than indignation. After 40 years' service, the emperor had prejudged his guilt, and injustice was sanctified by the presence and authority of the patriarch. The life of Belisarius was graciously spared, but his fortunes were sequestered, and from December to July he was guarded as a prisoner in his own palace. At length his innocence was acknowledged, his freedom and honor were restored, and death, which might be hastened by resentment and grief, removed him from the world in about 8 months after his deliverance. The name of Belisarius can never die, but instead of the funeral, the monuments, the statues so justly due to his memory, I only read that his treasures, the spoil of the Goths and Vandals, were immediately confiscated by the emperor. Some decent portion was reserved, however, for the use of his widow, and as Antonina had much to repent, she devoted the last remains of her life and fortune to the foundation of a convent. Such is the simple and genuine narrative of the fall of Belisarius and the ingratitude of Justinian. That he was deprived of his eyes and reduced by envy to beg his bread, give a penny to Belisarius the general, is a fiction of later times which has obtained credit or rather favor as a strange example of the vicissitudes of fortune. If the emperor could rejoice in the death of Belisarius, he enjoyed the base satisfaction only 8 months, the last period of a reign of 38 years, and a life of 83 years. It would be difficult to trace the character of a prince who is not the most conspicuous object of his own times, but the confessions of an enemy may be received as the safest evidence of his virtues. The resemblance of Justinian to the bust of Domitian is maliciously urged, with the acknowledgment, however, of a well-proportioned figure, a ruddy complexion, and a pleasing countenance. The emperor was easy of access, patient of hearing, courteous and affable in discourse, and a master of the angry passions which rage with such destructive violence in the breast of a despot. Procopius praises his temper, to reproach him with calm and deliberate cruelty. But in the conspiracies which attacked his authority and person, a more candid judge will approve the justice or admire the clemency of Justinian. He excelled in the private virtues of chastity and temperance, but the impartial love of beauty would have been less mischievous than his conjugal tenderness for Theodora, and his abstemious diet was regulated not by the prudence of a philosopher, but the superstition of a monk. His repasts were short and frugal. On solemn fasts he contented himself with water and vegetables, and such was his strength as well as fervor that he frequently passed 2 days and as many nights without tasting any food. The measure of his sleep was not less rigorous. After the repose of a single hour, the body was awakened by the soul, and to the astonishment of his chamberlain, Justinian walked or studied till the morning light. Such restless application prolonged his time for the acquisition of knowledge and the dispatch of business, and he might seriously deserve the reproach of confounding by minute and preposterous diligence the general order of his administration. The emperor professed himself a musician and architect, a poet and philosopher, a lawyer and theologian, and if he failed in the enterprise of reconciling the Christian sects, the review of the Roman jurisprudence is a noble monument of his spirit and industry. In the government of the empire he was less wise, or less successful. The age was unfortunate. The people was oppressed and discontented. Theodora abused her power. A succession of bad ministers disgraced his judgment, and Justinian was neither beloved in his life nor regretted at his death. The love of fame was deeply implanted in his breast, but he condescended to the poor ambition of titles, honors, and contemporary praise. And while he labored to fix the admiration, he forfeited the esteem and affection of the Romans. The design of the African and Italian wars was boldly conceived and executed, and his penetration discovered the talents of Belisarius in the camp, of Narses in the palace. But the name of the emperor is eclipsed by the names of his victorious generals, and Belisarius still lives to upbraid the envy and ingratitude of his sovereign. The partial favor of mankind applauds the genius of a conqueror who leads and directs his subjects in the exercise of arms. The characters of Philip II and of Justinian are distinguished by the cold ambition which delights in war and declines the dangers of the field. Yet a colossal statue of bronze represented the emperor on horseback, preparing to march against the Persians in the habit and armor of Achilles. In the great square before the church of Santa Sophia, this monument was raised on a brass column and a stone pedestal of 7 steps, and the pillar of Theodosius, which weighed 7,400 pounds of silver, was removed from the same place by the avarice and vanity of Justinian. Future princes were more just or indulgent to his memory. The elder Andronicus, in the beginning of the 14th century, repaired and beautified his equestrian statue. Since the fall of the empire, it has been melted into cannon by the victorious Turks. I shall conclude this chapter with the comets, the earthquakes, and the plague which astonished or afflicted the age of Justinian. 1. In the 5th year of his reign, and in the month of September, a comet was seen during 20 days in the western quarter of the heavens, and which shot its rays into the north. 8 years afterwards, while the sun was in Capricorn, another comet appeared to follow in the Sagittary. The size was gradually increasing. The head was in the east, the tail in the west, and it remained visible above 40 days. The nations who gazed with astonishment expected wars and calamities from their baleful influence, and these expectations were abundantly fulfilled. The astronomers dissembled their ignorance of the nature of these blazing stars, which they affected to represent as the floating meteors of the air, and few among them embraced the simple notion of Seneca and the Chaldeans that they are only planets of a longer period and more eccentric motion. Time and science have justified the conjectures and predictions of the Roman sage. The telescope has opened new worlds to the eyes of astronomers, and in the narrow space of history and fable, one and the same comet is already found to have revisited the Earth in 7 equal revolutions of 575 years. The first, which ascends beyond the Christian era 1,767 years, is coeval with Ogyges, the father of Grecian antiquity. and this appearance explains the tradition which Varro has preserved, that under his reign the planet Venus changed her colour, size, figure, and course. A prodigy without example either in past or succeeding ages. The second visit in the year 1193 is darkly implied in the fable of Electra, the seventh of the Pleiades, who have been reduced to six since the time of the Trojan War. That nymph, the wife of Dardanus, was unable to support the ruin of her country. She abandoned the dances of her sister Orbs, fled from the Zodiac to the North Pole, and obtained from her disheveled locks the name of the Comet. The third period expires in the year 618, a date that exactly agrees with the tremendous comet of the Sibyl, and perhaps of Pliny, which arose in the west two generations before the reign of Cyrus. The fourth apparition, 44 years before the birth of Christ, is, of all others, the most splendid and important. After the death of Caesar, a long-haired star was conspicuous to Rome and to the nations during the games which were exhibited by young Octavian in honour of Venus and his uncle. The vulgar opinion that it conveyed to heaven the divine soul of the dictator was cherished and consecrated by the piety of a statesman, while his secret superstition referred the comet to the glory of his own times. The fifth visit has been already ascribed to the fifth year of Justinian, which coincides with the 531st of the Christian era. And it may deserve notice that in this, as in the preceding instances, the comet was followed, though at a longer interval, by a remarkable paleness of the sun. The sixth return in the year 1106 is recorded by the chronicles of Europe and China. And in the first fervour of the Crusades, the Christians and the Mohammedans might surmise with equal reason that it portended the destruction of the infidels. The seventh phenomenon of 1680 was presented to the eyes of an enlightened age. The philosophy of Bayle dispelled a prejudice which Milton's muse had so recently adorned that the comet from its horrid hair shakes pestilence and war. Its road in the heavens was observed with exquisite skill by Flamsteed and Cassini, and the mathematical science of Bernoulli, Newton, and Halley investigated the laws of its revolutions. At the eighth period in the year 2355, their calculations may perhaps be verified by the astronomers of some future capital in the Siberian or American wilderness. 2. The near approach of a comet may injure or destroy the globe which we inhabit, but the changes on its surface have been hitherto produced by the action of volcanoes and earthquakes. The nature of the soil may indicate the countries most exposed to these formidable concussions, since they are caused by subterraneous fires, and such fires are kindled by the union and fermentation of iron and sulphur. But their times and effects appear to lie beyond the reach of human curiosity, and the philosopher will discreetly abstain from the prediction of earthquakes till he has counted the drops of water that silently filtrate on the inflammable mineral, and measured the caverns which increase by resistance the explosion of the imprisoned air. Without assigning the cause, history will distinguish the periods in which these calamitous events have been rare or frequent, and will observe that this fever of the earth raged with uncommon violence during the reign of Justinian. Each year is marked by the repetition of earthquakes of such duration that Constantinople has been shaken above 40 days, of such extent that the shock has been communicated to the whole surface of the globe, or at least of the Roman Empire. An impulsive or vibratory motion was felt. Enormous chasms were opened, huge and heavy bodies were discharged into the air, the sea alternately advanced and retreated beyond its ordinary bounds, and a mountain was torn from Libanus and cast into the waves, where it protected, as a mole, the new harbour of Botrys in Phoenicia. The stroke that agitates an anthill may crush the insect myriads in the dust. Yet truth must extort confession that man has industriously labored for his own destruction. The institution of great cities, which include a nation within the limits of a wall, almost realizes the wish of Caligula that the Roman people had but one neck. 250,000 persons are said to have perished in the earthquake of Antioch, whose domestic multitudes were swelled by the conflux of strangers to the festival of the Ascension. The loss of Berytus was of smaller account, but of much greater value. That city on the coast of Phoenicia was illustrated by the study of the civil law, which opened the surest road to wealth and dignity. The schools of Berytus were filled with the rising spirits of the age, and many a youth was lost in the earthquake who might have lived to be the scourge or the guardian of his country. In these disasters, the architect becomes the enemy of mankind. The hut of a savage or the tent of an Arab may be thrown down without injury to the inhabitant, and the Peruvians had reason to deride the folly of their Spanish conquerors, who, with so much cost and labor, erected their own sepulchres. The rich marbles of a patrician are dashed on his own head. A whole people is buried under the ruins of public and private edifices, and the conflagration is kindled and propagated by the innumerable fires which are necessary for the subsistence and manufactures of a great city. Instead of the mutual sympathy which might comfort and assist the distressed, they dreadfully experience the vices and passions which are released from the fear of punishment. The tottering houses are pillaged by intrepid avarice. Revenge embraces the moment and selects the victim. And the earth orphan swallows the assassin or the ravisher in the consummation of their crimes. Superstition involves the present danger with invisible terrors, and if the image of death may sometimes be subservient to the virtue or repentance of individuals, an affrighted people is more forcibly moved to expect the end of the world, or to deprecate with servile homage the wrath of an avenging deity. 3. Ethiopia and Egypt have been stigmatized in every age as the original source and seminary of the plague. In a damp, hot, stagnating air, this African fever is generated from the putrefaction of animal substances and especially from the swarm of locusts, not less destructive to mankind in their death than in their lives. The fatal disease which depopulated the earth in the time of Justinian and his successors first appeared in the neighborhood of Pelusium, between the Serbonian bog and the eastern channel of the Nile. From thence, tracing as it were a double path, it spread to the east, over Syria, Persia, and the Indies, and penetrated to the west, along the coast of Africa and over the continent of Europe. In the spring of the second year, Constantinople, during 3 or 4 months, was visited by the pestilence, and Procopius, who observed its progress and symptoms with the eyes of a physician, has emulated the skill and diligence of Thucydides in the description of the plague of Athens. The infection was sometimes announced by the visions of a distempered fancy, and the victim despaired as soon as he had heard the menace and felt the stroke of an invisible spectre. But the greater number, in their beds, in the streets, in their usual occupation, were surprised by slight fever. So slight, indeed, that neither the pulse nor the color of the patient gave any signs of the approaching danger. The same, the next or the succeeding day, it was declared by the swelling of the glands, particularly those of the groin, of the armpits, and under the ear. And when these buboes, or tumors, were opened, they were found to contain a coal, or black substance, of the size of a lentil. If they came to a just swelling and suppuration, the patient was saved by this kind and natural discharge of the morbid humor. But if they continued hard and dry, a mortification quickly ensued, and the fifth day was commonly the term of his life. The fever was often accompanied with lethargy or delirium. The bodies of the sick were covered with black pustules or carbuncles, the symptoms of immediate death. And in the constitutions too feeble to produce an eruption, the vomiting of blood was followed by mortification of the bowels. To pregnant women, the plague was generally mortal. Yet one infant was drawn alive from his dead mother, and three mothers survived the loss of their infected fetus. Youth was the most perilous season, and the female sex was less susceptible than the male. But every rank and profession was attacked with indiscriminate rage, and many of those who escaped were deprived of the use of their speech, without being secure from a return of the disorder. The physicians of Constantinople were zealous and skillful, but their art was baffled by the various symptoms and pertinacious vehemence of the disease. The same remedies were productive of contrary effects, and the event capriciously disappointed their prognostics of death or recovery. The order of funerals and the rite of sepulchres were confounded. Those who were left without friends or servants lay unburied in the streets, or in their desolate houses, and a magistrate was authorized to collect the promiscuous heaps of dead bodies, to transport them by land or water, and to inter them in deep pits beyond the precincts of the city. Their own danger and the prospect of public distress awakened some remorse in the minds of the most vicious of mankind. The confidence of health again revived their passions and habits. But philosophy must disdain the observation of Procopius that the lives of such men were guarded by the peculiar favor of fortune or providence. He forgot, or perhaps he secretly recollected, that the plague had touched the person of Justinian himself. But the abstemious diet of the emperor may suggest, as in the case of Socrates, a more rational and honorable cause for his recovery. During his sickness, the public consternation was expressed in the habits of the citizens, and their idleness and despondence occasioned a general scarcity in the capital of the East. Contagion is the inseparable symptom of the plague, which, by mutual respiration, is transfused from the infected persons to the lungs and stomach of those who approach them. While philosophers believe and tremble, it is singular that the existence of a real danger should have been denied by a people most prone to vain and imaginary terrors. Yet the fellow citizens of Procopius were satisfied, by some short and partial experience, that the infection could not be gained by the closest conversation, and this persuasion might support the assiduity of friends or physicians in the care of the sick, whom inhuman prudence would have condemned to solitude and despair. But the fatal security, like the predestination of the Turks, must have aided the progress of the contagion. And those salutary precautions to which Europe is indebted for her safety were unknown to the government of Justinian. No restraints were imposed on the free and frequent intercourse of the Roman provinces. From Persia to France, the nations were mingled and infected by wars and immigrations, and the pestilential odor which lurks for years in a bale of cotton was imported by the abuse of trade into the most distant regions. The mode of its propagation is explained by the remark of Procopius himself, that it always spread from the seacoast to the inland country. The most sequestered islands and mountains were successively visited. The places which had escaped the fury of its first passage were alone exposed to the contagion of the ensuing year. The winds might diffuse that subtle venom, but unless the atmosphere be previously disposed for its reception, the plague would soon expire in the cold or temperate climates of the earth. Such was the universal corruption of the air that the pestilence which burst forth in the 15th year of Justinian was not checked or alleviated by any difference of the seasons. In time its first malignity was abated and dispersed. The disease alternately languished and revived. But it was not till the end of a calamitous period of 52 years that mankind recovered their health, or the air resumed its pure and salubrious quality. No facts have been preserved to sustain an account or even a conjecture of the numbers that perished in this extraordinary mortality. I only find that during 3 months, 5 and at length 10,000 persons died each day at Constantinople, that many cities of the East were left vacant, and that in several districts of Italy the harvest and the vintage withered on the ground. The triple scourge of war, pestilence, and famine afflicted the subjects of Justinian, and his reign is disgraced by the visible decrease of the human species, which has never been repaired in some of the fairest countries of the globe. Chapter 44. Idea of the Roman Jurisprudence. The Laws of the Kings. The 12 of the Decemvirs. The Laws of the People. The Decrees of the Senate. The Edicts of the Magistrates and Emperors. Authority of the Civilians. Code, Pandects, Novels, and Institutes of Justinian. 1. Rights of persons. 2. Rights of things. 3. Private injuries and actions. 4. Crimes and punishments. Part 1. The vain titles of the victories of Justinian are crumbled into dust, but the name of the legislator is inscribed on a fair and everlasting monument. Under his reign and by his care, the civil jurisprudence was digested in the immortal works of the Code, the Pandects, and the Institutes. The public reason of the Romans has been silently or studiously transfused into the domestic institutions of Europe, and the laws of Justinian still command the respect or obedience of independent nations. Wise or fortunate is the prince who connects his own reputation with the honor or interest of a perpetual order of men. The defense of their founder is the first cause which in every age has exercised the zeal and industry of the civilians. They piously commemorate his virtues, dissemble or deny his failings, and fiercely chastise the guilt or folly of the rebels who presume to sully the majesty of the people. The idolatry of love has provoked, as it usually happens, the rancor of opposition. The character of Justinian has been exposed to the blind vehemence of flattery and invective, and the injustice of a sect, the Anti-Trebonians, has refused all praise and merit to the prince, his ministers, and his laws. Attached to no party, interested only for the truth and candor of history, and directed by the most temperate and skillful guides, I enter with just diffidence on the subject of civil law, which has exhausted so many learned lives and clothed the walls of such spacious libraries. In a single, if possible in a short, chapter, I shall trace the Roman jurisprudence from Romulus to Justinian, appreciate the labors of that emperor, and pause to contemplate the principles of a science so important to the peace and happiness of society. The laws of a nation form the most instructive portion of its history, and although I have devoted myself to write the annals of a declining monarchy, I shall embrace the occasion to breathe the pure and invigorating air of the Republic. The primitive government of Rome was composed, with some political skill, of an elective king, a council of nobles, and a general assembly of the people. War and religion were administered by the supreme magistrate, and he alone proposed the laws which were debated in the Senate and finally ratified or rejected by a majority of votes in the 30 curiae, or parishes, of the city. Romulus, Numa, and Servius Tullius are celebrated as the most ancient legislators, and each of them claims his peculiar part in the threefold division of jurisprudence. The laws of marriage, the education of children, and the authority of parents, which may seem to draw their origin from nature itself, are ascribed to the untutored wisdom of Romulus. The law of nations and of religious worship, which Numa introduced, was derived from his nocturnal converse with the nymph Egeria. The civil law is attributed to the experience of Servius. He balanced the rights and fortunes of the seven classes of citizens, and guarded by 50 new regulations the observance of contracts and the punishment of crimes. The state, which he had inclined towards a democracy, was changed by the last Tarquin into a lawless despotism. And when the kingly office was abolished, the patricians engrossed the benefits of freedom. The royal laws became odious or obsolete. The mysterious deposit was silently preserved by the priests and nobles, and at the end of 60 years the citizens of Rome still complained that they were ruled by the arbitrary sentence of the magistrates. Yet the positive institutions of the kings had blended themselves with the public and private manners of the city. Some fragments of that venerable jurisprudence were compiled by the diligence of antiquarians, and above 20 texts still speak the rudeness of the Pelasgic idiom of the Latins. I shall not repeat the well-known story of the Decemvirs, who sullied by their actions the honor of inscribing on brass or wood or ivory the 12 tables of the Roman laws. They were dictated by the rigid and jealous spirit of an aristocracy which had yielded with reluctance to the just demands of the people. But the substance of the 12 tables was adapted to the state of the city, and the Romans had emerged from barbarism, since they were capable of studying and embracing the institutions of their more enlightened neighbors. A wise Ephesian was driven by envy from his native country. Before he could reach the shores of Latium, he had observed the various forms of human nature and civil society. He imparted his knowledge to the legislators of Rome, and a statue was erected in the Forum to the perpetual memory of Hermodorus. The names and divisions of the copper money, the sole coin of the infant state, were of Dorian origin. The harvests of Campania and Sicily relieved the wants of a people whose agriculture was often interrupted by war and faction. And since the trade was established, the deputies who sailed from the Tiber might return from the same harbors with a more precious cargo of political wisdom. The colonies of Great Greece had transported and improved the arts of their mother country. Cumae and Rhegium, Crotona and Tarentum, Agrigentum and Syracuse were in the rank of the most flourishing cities. The disciples of Pythagoras applied philosophy to the use of government. The unwritten laws of Charondas accepted the aid of poetry and music, and Zeleucus framed the Republic of the Locrians, which stood without alteration above 200 years. From a similar motive of national pride, both Livy and Dionysius are willing to believe that the deputies of Rome visited Athens under the wise and splendid administration of Pericles, and the laws of Solon were transfused into the 12 tables. If such an embassy had indeed been received from the barbarians of Hesperia, the Roman name would have been familiar to the Greeks before the reign of Alexander, and the faintest evidence would have been explored and celebrated by the curiosity of succeeding times. But the Athenian monuments are silent, nor will it seem credible that the patricians should undertake a long and perilous navigation to copy the purest model of democracy. In the comparison of the tables of Solon with those of the Decemvirs, some casual resemblance may be found, some rules which nature and reason have revealed to every society, some proofs of a common descent from Egypt or Phoenicia. But in all the great lines of public and private jurisprudence, the legislators of Rome and Athens appear to be strangers or adverse at each other. Part 2. Whatever might be the origin or the merit of the 12 tables, they obtained among the Romans that blind and partial reverence which the lawyers of every country delight to bestow on their municipal institutions. The study is recommended by Cicero as equally pleasant and instructive. They amuse the mind by the remembrance of old words and the portrait of ancient manners. They inculcate the soundest principles of government and morals, and I am not afraid to affirm that the brief composition of the Decemvirs surpasses in genuine value the libraries of Grecian philosophy. How admirable, says Tully, with honest or affected prejudice, is the wisdom of our ancestors. We alone are the masters of civil prudence, and our superiority is the more conspicuous if we deign to cast our eyes on the rude and almost ridiculous jurisprudence of Draco, of Solon, and of Lycurgus. The 12 tables were committed to the memory of the young and the meditation of the old. They were transcribed and illustrated with learned diligence. They had escaped the flames of the Gauls. They subsisted in the age of Justinian, and their subsequent loss has been imperfectly restored by the labors of modern critics. But although these venerable monuments were considered as the rule of right and the fountain of justice, they were overwhelmed by the weight and variety of new laws, which at the end of 5 centuries became a grievance more intolerable than the vices of the city. 3,000 brass plates, the acts of the Senate of the people, were deposited in the capital, and some of the acts, as the Julian law against extortion, surpassed the number of 100 chapters. The Decemvirs had neglected to import the sanction of Zaleucus, which so long maintained the integrity of his republic. A Locrian, who proposed any new law, stood forth in the assembly of the people with a cord round his neck, and if the law was rejected, the innovator was instantly strangled. The Decemvirs had been named, and their tables were approved by an assembly of the centuries, in which riches preponderated against numbers. To the first class of Romans, the proprietors of 100,000 pounds of copper, 98 votes were assigned, and only 95 were left for the 6 inferior classes, distributed according to their substance by the artful policy of Servius. But the tribunes soon established a more specious and popular maxim, that every citizen has an equal right to enact the laws which he is bound to obey. Instead of the centuries, they convened the tribes, and the patricians, after an impotent struggle, submitted to the decrees of an assembly in which their votes were confounded with those of the meanest plebeians. Yet as long as the tribes successively passed over narrow bridges and gave their voices aloud, the conduct of each citizen was exposed to the eyes and ears of his friends and countrymen. The insolvent debtor consulted the wishes of his creditor. The client would have blushed to oppose the views of his patron. The general was followed by his veterans, and the aspect of a grave magistrate was a living lesson to the multitude. A new method of secret ballot abolished the influence of fear and shame, of honor and interest, and the abuse of freedom accelerated the progress of anarchy and despotism. The Romans had aspired to be equal. They were leveled by the equality of servitude, and the dictates of Augustus were patiently ratified by the formal consent of the tribes or centuries. Once and once only he experienced a sincere and strenuous opposition. His subjects had resigned all political liberty. They defended the freedom of domestic life. A law which enforced the obligation and strengthened the bonds of marriage was clamorously rejected. Propertius, in the arms of Delia, applauded the victory of licentious love, and the project of reform was suspended till a new and more tractable generation had arisen in the world. Such an example was not necessary to instruct a prudent usurper of the mischief of popular assemblies, and their abolition, which Augustus had silently prepared, was accomplished without resistance and almost without notice on the accession of his successor. 60,000 plebeian legislators, whom numbers made formidable and poverty secure, were supplanted by 600 senators who held their honors, their fortunes, and their lives by the clemency of the emperor. The loss of executive power was alleviated by the gift of legislative authority. And Ulpian might assert, after the practice of 200 years, that the decrees of the Senate obtained the force and validity of laws. In the times of freedom, the resolves of the people had often been dictated by the passion or error of the moment. The Cornelian, Pompeian, and Julian laws were adapted by single hand to the prevailing disorders. But the Senate, under the reign of the Caesars, was composed of magistrates and lawyers, and in questions of private jurisprudence, the integrity of their judgment was seldom perverted by fear or interest. The silence or ambiguity of the laws was supplied by the occasional edicts of those magistrates who were invested with the honors of the state. This ancient prerogative of the Roman kings was transferred in their respective offices to the consuls and dictators, the censors and praetors, and a similar right was assumed by the tribunes of the people, the aediles, and the proconsuls. At Rome and in the provinces, the duties of the subject and the intentions of the governor were proclaimed, and the civil jurisprudence was reformed by the annual edicts of the supreme judge, the praetor of the city. As soon as he ascended his tribunal, he announced by the voice of the crier, and afterwards inscribed on a white wall, the rules which he proposed to follow in the decision of doubtful cases, and the relief which his equity would afford from the precise rigor of ancient statutes. A principle of discretion more congenial to monarchy was introduced into the republic. The art of respecting the name and eluding the efficacy of the laws was improved by successive praetors. Subtleties and fictions were invented to defeat the plainest meaning of the decemvirs, and where the end was salutary, the means were frequently absurd. The secret or probable wish of the dead was suffered to prevail over the order of succession and the forms of testaments, and the claimant, who was excluded from the character of heir, accepted with equal pleasure from an indulgent praetor the possession of the goods of his late kinsman or benefactor. In the redress of private wrongs, compensations and fines were substituted to the obsolete rigor of the 12 tables. Time and space were annihilated by fanciful suppositions, and the plea of youth or fraud or violence annulled the obligation or excused the performance of an inconvenient contract. A jurisdiction thus vague and arbitrary was exposed to the most dangerous abuse. The substance as well as the form of justice were often sacrificed to the prejudices of virtue, the bias of laudable affection, and the grosser seductions of interest or resentment. But the terrors or vices of each praetor expired with his annual office. Such maxims alone as had been approved by reason and practice were copied by succeeding judges. The rule of proceeding was defined by the solution of new cases, and the temptations of injustice were removed by the Cornelian law, which compelled the praetor of the year to adhere to the spirit and letter of his first proclamation. It was reserved for the curiosity and learning of Adrian to accomplish the design which had been conceived by the genius of Caesar, and the praetorship of Salvius Julian, an eminent lawyer, was immortalized by the composition of the perpetual edict. This well-digested code was ratified by the emperor and the senate. The long divorce of law and equity was at length reconciled, and instead of the 12 tables, the perpetual edict was fixed as the invariable standard of civil jurisprudence. From Augustus to Trajan, the modest Caesars were content to promulgate their edicts in the various characters of a Roman magistrate. And in the decrees of the Senate, the epistles and orations of the prince were respectfully inserted. Adrian appears to have been the first who assumed, without disguise, the plenitude of legislative power. And this innovation, so agreeable to his active mind, was countenanced by the patience of the times and his long absence from the seat of government. The same policy was embraced by succeeding monarchs, and according to the harsh metaphor of Tertullian, the gloomy and intricate forest of ancient laws was cleared away by the acts of royal mandates and constitutions. During four centuries, from Adrian to Justinian, the public and private jurisprudence was moulded by the will of the sovereign, and few institutions, either human or divine, were permitted to stand on their former basis. The origin of imperial legislation was concealed by the darkness of ages and the terrors of armed despotism, and a double fiction was propagated by the servility, or perhaps the ignorance, of the civilians who basked in the sunshine of the Roman and Byzantine courts. To the prayer of the ancient Caesars, the people, or the Senate, had sometimes granted a personal exemption from the obligation and penalty of particular statutes, and each indulgence was an act of jurisdiction exercised by the Republic over the first of her citizens. His humble privilege was at length transformed into the prerogative of a tyrant, and the Latin expression of released from the laws was supposed to exalt the emperor above all human restraints, and to leave his conscience and reason as the sacred measure of his conduct. A similar dependence was implied in the decrees of the Senate, which in every reign defined the titles and powers of an elective magistrate. But it was not before the ideas and even the language of the Romans had been corrupted that a royal law and an irrevocable gift of the people were created by the fancy of Ulpian, or more probably of Trebonian himself. And the origin of imperial power, though false in fact and slavish in its consequence, was supported on a principle of freedom and justice. The pleasure of the emperor has the vigor and effect of law, since the Roman people, by the royal law, have transferred to their prince the full extent of their own power and sovereignty. The will of a single man, of a child, perhaps, was allowed to prevail over the wisdom of ages and the inclinations of millions. And the degenerate Greeks were proud to declare that in his hands alone the arbitrary exercise of legislation could be safely deposited. "What interest or passion," exclaims Theophilus in the court of Justinian, "can reach the calm and sublime elevation of the monarch? He is already master of the lives and fortunes of his subjects, and those who have incurred his displeasure are already numbered with the dead." Disdaining the language of flattery, the historian may confess that in questions of private jurisprudence, the absolute sovereign of a great empire can seldom be influenced by any personal considerations. Virtue, or even reason, will suggest to his impartial mind that he is the guardian of peace and equity, and that the interest of society is inseparably connected with his own. Under the weakest and most vicious reign, the seat of justice was filled by the wisdom and integrity of Papinian and Ulpian, and the purest materials of the Code and Pandects are inscribed with the names of Caracalla and his ministers. The tyrant of Rome was sometimes the benefactor of the provinces. A dagger terminated the crimes of Domitian, but the prudence of Nerva confirmed his acts, which, in the joy of their deliverance, had been rescinded by an indignant senate. Yet in the rescripts, replies to the consultations of the magistrates, the wisest of princes might be deceived by partial exposition of the case. And this abuse, which placed their hasty decisions on the same level with mature and deliberate acts of legislation, was ineffectually condemned by the sense and example of Trajan. The rescripts of the emperor, his grants and decrees, his edicts and pragmatic sanctions, were subscribed in purple ink and transmitted to the provinces as general or special laws, which the magistrates were bound to execute and the people to obey. But as their number continually multiplied,